Each stage of a woman's life brings new possibilities, exciting choices, and sometimes difficult challenges. At Astellas, we understand women want solutions that enable a life of continued possibilities. We will work to elevate the conversation around women's midlife health and provide resources that demonstrate our commitment to women's changing healthcare needs during this stage. Women's Health at Astellas, powering possibilities for women in midlife.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Talks podcast. My name is Dawn Davis. I'm a professor of dermatology and pediatrics at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And today's topic is topical and non-hormonal therapies. I have two colleagues who are experts in this area joining me today, Dr. Hannah Nord-Hughes and also Miss Amber Klingworth. Welcome, ladies, to the podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
So Hannah and Amber, would you just like to take a moment to introduce yourselves to the audience?
Sure. My name is Hannah Nord-Hughes. I am a menopause physician in the Menopause and Women's Sexual Health Clinic at Mayo, and I do quite a bit of work with the medical education as well.
And my name is Amber, so I'm a PA. I also work in the Menopause and Sexual Health Clinic, and I've been here for about 7 years.
Thank you both. Well, as a dermatologist, while I do use systemic therapies often, I'm obviously an advocate of topical therapies, and my patients often ask about non-hormonal treatments of multiple skin diseases. So in that vein, can you tell us why it's really important to educate our patients, but also our healthcare professional colleagues on the use of topical medications and non-hormonal treatments for menopause?
Yeah, I think this is a really important topic in general, because we know that women who are going through a menopause transition, anytime, you know, perimenopause through menopause transition, have symptoms of hot flashes and night sweats or sexual dysfunction, vaginal dryness, and they're often undertreated. Women have symptoms on average for 7 to 10 years. And so that's not a short period of their life. Many women have symptoms for much longer than that. And so knowing what options are available, not just for the hormone perspective, are extremely important.
Yeah, so I kind of agree with Hannah. So I tell everybody, if they have ovaries, you're going to go through menopause at some point. And there's so many of the symptoms that come with that. And so we no longer want women just to push through. We have so many different options, prescriptions, non-prescriptions. So we like to review that with everyone.
Well, it's my understanding that menopause, while it is a significant health issue for the individual patient, it's also an important public health concern, because approximately 90 million women will be postmenopausal in the United States by the year 2060, and that it costs a lost days of work of $1.8 billion a year and nearly $25 billion every year in medical costs. Is that true?
It is. Yeah, there have been a couple really interesting publications recently, one of them by one of our colleagues, Dr. Ek Kapoor, and they did a lot of evaluation into the impact in the workforce, and it's really huge. And so if you think about if that were happening in a male population, this probably would have gotten a lot of information a lot sooner.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, firstly, before we dive into the actual topic, there's just a technical clarifying question I think would be helpful for our educated audience. There's a lot of discussion about bioidentical hormone therapies. Will we be discussing that today? And is that considered different than hormone therapy? Or would that really classify as hormone therapy, just a different subtype?
They are technically the same. It's just marketed a little different. So we like to use FDA-approved hormone therapy, and it's technically what we would think is bioidentical, what your body naturally makes. There's kind of two different thoughts on hormones right now. So integrative approach will do more of bioidentical and compounding. So that would be the difference between them.
For today's purposes, I think the goal would be to talk about mostly the non-hormone options for all the patients that couldn't take hormones or prefer to avoid hormones. We will talk a little bit about potentially vaginal estrogens, and technically those are hormones, but with very little systemic absorption. And so we think of them slightly differently than the systemic hormone therapies, but there are bioidentical, estradiol would be the bioidentical FDA-approved version of a vaginal estrogen that we may talk about later.
Well, let's start just with the basics. Is hormonal therapy, particularly estrogen therapy, is that considered the gold standard and optimal treatment in general for most women who are perimenopausal or menopausal?
I would say yes. It's the most effective way of treating many of the symptoms. So if we use hormone therapy and we're trying to treat hot flashes and night sweats, we're going to get around a 90% reduction of symptoms. So that's kind of my first go-to. But there again, there's a lot of options if a patient can't use hormones.
Absolutely, I agree.
Okay, excellent. And then there are some patients who literally can't take hormones for gold standard therapy during perimenopause and menopause. Who are those patients who really need to qualify for other treatment options?
Yeah, we know that hormones are the most effective, but there are certainly people that can't take them. And so those would really be estrogen sensitive cancers. Most commonly, we think about breast cancer, but there's also other estrogen sensitive tumors that we would want to be conscious about, especially during treatment phases. And so those would be reasons we wouldn't want to stimulate any kind of tumor growth with systemic estrogen therapy. And oftentimes those patients are on estrogen blocking medications for therapy as well. The other big contraindications would be significant history of myocardial infarction or stroke or clinically significant cardiovascular disease, as well as potentially significant history of venous thromboembolism, especially if there have been recurrent issues or family inherited thromboembolic disorders.
What about smoking?
So smoking is not a specific contraindication. It might change the type of hormones we use. I definitely will talk about it. That increases their risk, and ideally they shouldn't smoke, but we all know that's not just a quick stop for a lot of people. So I probably wouldn't reach for like an oral estrogen that has a different risk. I would try to navigate more to that topical or transdermal. So I would say it's not a hard no to hormone therapy, but it's a discussion about what risk they might be taking on.
And then what about the age of the patient? Some women go into early premature menopause in their late 20s, early 30s, and some ladies don't start it until their late 50s. Is there a risk or a preference or contraindication based on age?
So in those premature menopause categories, those are women that, unless there's a reason, you know, estrogen sensitive tumor or something like that, that they could not get estrogen, it is definitely needed for their body. They would otherwise have those hormones around until that natural age of menopause. So that's almost a separate category of patients to talk about. Women that are 10 years or more beyond the menopause transition and older than age 60 at the time of starting hormones would be less preferable. We would prefer to start with non-hormone options in most cases for those women.
I was going to say for the younger population, a big thing to note, and Dr. Nordius was right, like they should have it, but I always like to point out, even if they're not symptomatic. So if these women have no hot flashes, no night sweats, and they're still in early menopause, that's a whole nother discussion. They need it for general health, not symptom management.
And then also just another nuance before we talk about the specific non-hormonal options. If somebody doesn't know they're in perimenopause or menopause, or for some reason they decide not to seek treatment, and then they reach a tipping point where they're interested, is there water under the bridge and things are not as efficacious for the patient once they finally start therapy? Or can you really pick up where you left off?
Yeah, for the most part, there's not a lot of good evidence that starting treating symptoms later is less efficacious. It's more that risk with hormones specifically that we're going to get the higher benefit to risk ratio early on and more risk, less benefit later from the hormones. But for non-hormonal treatments, there's not a lot of evidence that later is bad or that we're not going to get the same benefit down the road.
Excellent. Well, women don't like flushing, and a lot of women do have vasomotor symptoms. What if somebody can't take hormones or wants to avoid hormones? Are there non-hormonal options or topical options for flushing?
So there's a lot of different options, and it all depends on how, I would say, the word aggressive they want to be. So there are like non-prescriptions. So there's lifestyle and alternative things they can trial, as well as prescription choices. So it might be helpful if we kind of address them separately, because there's a couple in each different category.
Fantastic. Why don't you tell me more about them?
I'll start with kind of those lifestyle things. So I always ask women, can you figure out something that's triggering your symptoms? And so from a diet perspective, some people really know like hot beverages, like their coffee and tea, they're going to have their morning coffee, they're going to have their flush to go with it. Some people, it's spicy food, caffeine, alcohol is really notorious. So wine, any type of alcoholic beverage is really known to kind of cause those hot flashes. And then the less common, but often told to me from my patients, is processed sugar. So when they reach for their sweets, sometimes they have hot flashes that way as well. So if they can look at diet and see if they can find any triggers, sometimes that is enough to solve the problem initially when they're in that early stage of perimenopause.
Yeah, a lot of the times by their coming to you, they've already tried that. So these are good things for people to be aware of, but most of the studies are in patients that have already done those things and now they're wanting something else. So for patients that do want a non-medication option, and they've already tried those initial finding their triggers and trying to have healthy lifestyle. There are things that have good evidence, such as cognitive behavioral therapy and actually clinical hypnosis, that can reduce the severity and intensity of symptoms. And so those are definitely good things. They're so low risk that it's definitely worth trying, because there's so few side effects, and many women can get significant benefit from those non-medication options if they're trying to avoid medications with side effects and things like that.
So if someone is interested in cognitive behavioral therapy, hypnosis, yoga practices, et cetera, is it difficult to find a professional who's an expert in that? And do you have to seek somebody who has expertise in specifically addressing the vasomotor function, or can you go to more of a general approach?
I think it's hard to find. I don't even have someone I refer to here at Mayo for like the hypnosis piece. I think the cognitive piece might be a little bit simpler. But yeah, it's definitely not something that is readily available. So it would take a little bit more effort on a patient's side to find someone that's reputable.
Yeah, I think if they already have somebody that they've worked with for cognitive behavioral therapy in the past, those same types of skills can be useful in just applying them to vasomotor symptoms and those triggers instead of their anxiety triggers or something like that. But certainly it's not going to be a one size fits all. And you have to find somebody that you're comfortable with if you don't already have an established provider for that.
Excellent. Well, a lot of your patients might be seeing in the media that there's a new medication for hot flashes. How does it work and who would benefit?
Yeah, so there have been multiple medications that have worked for hot flashes for a long time, but really few that are actually FDA approved. So for a long time, the only one we actually had FDA approved was paroxetine for vasomotor symptoms. But now there's this new kid on the block. Veozah is the brand name, or fezolinetant. And so it's interesting because it's a totally new class of medications, even. It's the first in class. So it's a neurokinin 3 receptor antagonist. So it works by blocking the receptors in the brain that usually are kind of blocked by estrogen and stimulated by neurokinin B. And so as estrogen goes down, we get this unopposed neurokinin B stimulation, which causes flushing, vasodilation, those vasomotor symptoms. And so this blocks that receptor right at kind of the source. So we think of it as treating those vasomotor symptoms at the actual source rather than just as a side effect of another medication. So it's exciting to think about. It's still really new. And so I think that's where the real world evidence will come in time. The biggest concerns that I think most people will have is just, what is that long-term safety going to look like? And as any new medications come out, cost is always a concern. So certainly some patients will qualify for the cost savings programs through the manufacturer, but not every patient's going to qualify for that.
I say it seems like a nice medication because it's once a day. So taking one pill is pretty easy. Side effects are pretty minimal. Abdominal pain is, I think, the most common. Hot flashing is listed, but it's not one of the more common ones on the study. The biggest thing is there's some more testing. So there's some blood work that you have to do for this medication. So you have to check a liver function test before you start it to make sure that the levels are normal. And then you repeat those again at 3, 6, and 9 months. So there's a little bit more follow-up that's necessary for the patient.
That's very, very helpful. Besides hot flashes, what other menopausal concerns do patients present with that we can help regulate with non-hormonal or topical treatments?
Sleep is probably the second most common concern, and it doesn't actually seem to respond to hormones, or current literature doesn't support that it does, unless you're having hot flashes and night sweats. So to manage sleep, I focus a lot on that cognitive-based therapy, or CBTI. So I talk a lot about sleep hygiene, and I go over that with the patients.
Other symptoms that come along with it, sleep is definitely a huge one, and those hot flashes, but sometimes someone will have more irritability or mood symptoms that come along with it as well. Especially during perimenopause, we often explain it to women that those normal fluctuations in hormones that they get during PMS essentially happen like on a daily basis. So they're fluctuating their levels up and down drastically. And so there's a ton of hormone instability during perimenopause, and all those fluctuations can cause any of the symptoms that they would normally get during their PMS cycles, but constantly, basically. And so any of those symptoms that they have and struggle with can be more common during perimenopause. It's exactly something to look forward to, right?
What about heart palpitations?
Yeah. Heart palpitations definitely can be something that come along with perimenopause as well. And they're not necessarily associated with underlying rhythm disorders, but as women are aging, underlying disorders are also common. So you have to think about, how do we rule out those scary things or more concerning things, and then treat the symptomatic palpitations too.
And those would be treated in non-hormonal ways, correct?
Yes. Generally speaking, you would want to treat the, if there is an underlying rhythm disorder, you would treat that separately. I'll say many of the benign palpitations, if you're treating their other vasomotor symptoms, sometimes those will improve with that, but there's not a lot of evidence to support treating just the palpitations with the medications you would use for hot flashes and night sweats. The other medications I think are important to discuss that aren't FDA approved, but do work and have good evidence for vasomotor symptoms are oxybutynin, actually, which is overactive bladder medication, but really helps with hot flashes and sweats, gabapentin, and the SSRIs and SNRIs. And so especially if these women are having multiple symptoms or can't take hormones because of cancer treatments, for example, something like that, we always try to think about what other symptoms are they having? Do they have neuropathy from chemotherapy? And so they may benefit from gabapentin for multiple reasons. Are they having overactive bladder issues at the same time and may benefit for two benefits with one medication?
Yeah, I'm always looking for something if I'm not using hormones that's going to treat too. So if they're having those mood fluctuations, maybe I reach for that SSRI, SNRI group because I can maybe make the hot flashes better and help with some of that irritability they're feeling.
I know that we've talked about meditation and cognitive behavioral therapy and highly refined sugars and things, but women in my clinic always ask about particular specific exercises or particular food triggers or food alleviators. Are there any particular exercises and any specific foods that perhaps trigger flushing or trigger estrogen flares or that we should be aware of?
On an anecdotal basis, many women will say that they have found something that makes their symptoms worse. But when we really try to study it in high quality trials, there's not a lot of evidence that any one particular either supplement, exercise type, or food triggers have been consistent across the board. So I think there's a lot of individualization that still needs to be made. So it's hard to make big, broad, sweeping statements about this is what we would recommend. Certainly exercise is going to be helpful for everyone in general for their health and for mental health. But if we look at actual improvement of vasomotor symptoms, that alone, you know, doesn't necessarily correlate.
I think of adding in. So again, people are always trying to find something without a prescription. And so sometimes I'll talk about soy. So there is always a potential that someone can metabolize soy into a phytoestrogen. So if they already are fine eating soy, some people avoid for their own personal reasons. Maybe they add soy milk to their smoothie and try having like 1 to 2 servings a day. And there's some evidence that might help. But again, not everybody's body is able to metabolize that over. And you don't know until you try eating it. So I usually tell them to try it for 3 months. And if it's not getting better and they don't like the taste of the soy product, to just stop, because that's a pretty low risk thing they could use as well.
And some women have the opposite and they try to avoid soy because they understand that sometimes it can be converted to estrogen. And even if they themselves don't have a personal or family history of breast cancer or gynecologic malignancies, they'll try to limit their soy intake because they're worried that it may anecdotally increase their risk for hormone-related tumors. Can you comment on that?
I tell them if you're eating it, it's really safe. So I know even our breast clinic will say eating soy is fine. I usually ask them to avoid supplements of soy because I have no idea about the concentration. But 1 to 2 serving studies have really supported that it's a safe amount if you were eating it, even if it were to convert over to a phytoestrogen.
And there's not a good readily available test to know who does and does not have the enzyme to convert. And so there's not a lot of good ways to really study that, unfortunately, to get good quality individualization yet.
Maybe in the future. Well, let's pivot to topical products. A lot of women will want to apply topical products for non-flushing indications. For example, as a dermatologist, a lot of women in perimenopause and menopause complain of vaginal dryness or mucosal dryness in general, or perhaps, you know, vulvovaginary or genital concerns with regards to urination or sexual activity. Are there topical products that we can use that are not hormone related?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different options out there. So if you're treating, so now the big mouthful is genital urinary syndrome of menopause, right? So it affects all the different organs. If it's sexual health, you're always going to reach for a good lubricant first. So if they're feeling dry and uncomfortable, you want a good lubricant, and there's water-based and there's silicone. So we always ask them to look for things with not a lot of additives. So trying to avoid glycerins and parabens when you're looking for lubricants. Water-based works great, but it can dry up. So you either have to add more or it can get a little bit sticky, so you could even add water. Silicone is another great product that's going to stay slippery longer. My caveat to this is if your partner struggles with erectile concerns, silicone might be too slippery for them. So it does not cause erectile dysfunction, but it can make matters a little bit worse for them. So always asking about that partner as well when you're looking for a good lubricant.
Absolutely. Then the other side of that is the lubricants are really important for that intimacy in the short term, but they're really formulated for short-term use. And so if women are having more longer-term day-to-day dryness, consistent symptoms, increased vaginal infections, urinary symptoms, things like that, the non-hormonal medications and options would be moisturizers. And so those are formulated differently. They actually pull moisture into the tissues and can last up to 72 hours before that vaginal lining kind of sloughs at its normal 72-hour time frame and then need to be reapplied. So the same concept applies that Amber just talked about, avoiding the parabens and glycerins. We want them to be pH balanced, and doing that 3 to 4 times a week for many women is enough to really help keep that tissue kind of healthy and moisturized to minimize a lot of those symptoms.
I always explain, you moisturize your face, you can moisturize your vulva. It's just the products are formulated differently. So kind of think of it the same idea.
I have a very similar phrase. We don't think twice about moisturizing our face, our neck, and our bodies, but somehow we feel strange, whether we're a man or a woman, about moisturizing our genital area, but we moisturize all other areas of skin. So we shouldn't feel badly about that. And as we age, we need to moisturize everywhere more. And that includes downstairs.
Absolutely.
So I have an adage that lubricant is for the canal on the inside, but moisturizers are for the outside, because sometimes people get those confused.
Yeah. The other thing I'll compare it to sometimes is dry mouth. So your mouth is a mucous membrane. You get dry mouth, you can sip water. You can't just sip water for your vagina. So this like helps to do that kind of on a routine basis.
Absolutely. We talked about topical moisturizers, topical lubricants, but a lot of women do use topical estrogen or other sorts of hormone creams. Let's talk first about topical testosterone. Is there a reason where a woman would currently want to use topical testosterone, or pretty much has everyone shifted over time to topical estrogen? Because a long time ago, everyone used to use testosterone for a woman's health condition. So where is the needle or the balance of, you know, testosterone versus estrogen therapy?
So first, to talk about testosterone, there's kind of two ways to think about that. One is systemic testosterone that is topically provided. So those would be indicated for women who are postmenopausal and have libido concern, because there's not an FDA approved version. Compound a low dose of topical testosterone for libido concerns. And that's usually not applied actually vaginally, but to either thigh or calf. And the goal is really to keep women in the female range. And so those would be some concerns, but it's not studied well in patients that have contraindications like breast cancer. And so those would still be potentially higher risk circumstances if they're in active treatment for breast cancer, not knowing what that long-term impact would be on their active cancer. For vaginal symptoms, sometimes in very nuanced situations, we can add testosterone, but the mainstay, because of the availability of products and quality of evidence, is really topical low-dose vaginal estrogen for most of the symptoms at this time.
Are there indications when patients can't use topical estrogen because they're supposed to avoid estrogen? Like, is using topical estrogen in your genital area equivalent to some degree to taking a systemic estrogen because it's partially absorbed into the bloodstream through the mucosa?
So generally, we think of them very different, right? So there's always those nuances. If you have a patient with breast cancer and it's ERPR positive, should you avoid a vaginal estrogen? And I really think it's a risk-benefit discussion with your patient, because the studies, the most recent two that just came out, they actually contradict each other a little bit. If you have a person who has should avoid systemic estrogen, there's very rare circumstances I won't give them vaginal estrogen, but it's a very different risk-benefit discussion because the studies are limited. And I'm always trying those non-hormonal options first. So, right, are they using a moisturizer? Have they tried lubricant? But vaginal estrogen is kind of always on my radar.
The estrogen-sensitive tumors are always the ones that give us the most pause, and we want to coordinate with oncology just based on if they're on active aromatase inhibitors and the goal is to get them to like no estrogen whatsoever, then we worry about that small level of systemic absorption. But things like coronary artery disease, where we wouldn't use systemic estrogen, those same contraindications for vaginal estrogen generally don't apply. These are such low doses that we have good quality evidence that the systemic absorption is pretty minimal and stays in the normal postmenopausal range for most of those women. And so most of those contraindications don't apply, and vaginal estrogens are still on the table for most patients who have tried those non-hormonal things and are still struggling. And it's a really good option.
Good. So we have over-the-counter things like moisturizers and lubricants. We have prescription things like topical testosterone and estrogen. Are there prescription topical non-hormonal creams, lotions, ointments, et cetera, that you would use in the vulvovaginal area for perimenopause or menopause?
Not generally. Most of the prescription-based things are going to be hormone-based or pro-hormone. There's also a vaginal DHEA, which is a pro-hormone, so it's aromatized to estrogen and testosterone, and there's the vaginal suppository for that, but that would be the prescription-based. Most of the non-hormonal things are going to be over-the-counter.
And we always like to take a moment during the podcast to talk about minority or underrepresented populations and to recognize diversity, equity, and inclusion. Are there anything specific to treatments or over-the-counter medications or naturalistic therapies for patients who are of a minority race or ethnicity for the LGBTQIA population? Could you comment on that?
I think in general, as far as vasomotor symptoms go, I will say that oftentimes women of African descent have worse vasomotor symptoms in many of our studies and are often undertreated. So it's equally important to discuss, to screen, to ask, and to treat these women, whether hormones or non-hormones, because they suffer equally or more and are not treated to the same level. For any sexual health concern, I think the LGBTQIA question is really important, because oftentimes we study these patients who are primarily cisgender women in heterosexual relationships, and the types of sexual health concerns may not be the same. And so asking specifically about their relationship, the communication, their partners in that therapeutic alliance with your patients, I think is really important to tailor specifically the sexual health products or concerns that they're going to most benefit from.
Yes, I agree with Dr. Nordhus or Hannah. So I always try to ask and not assume what type of sexual activity they're having, and that helps figure out what type of product they should use. So always asking what kind of activity they're engaging in, and then we can help tailor the product specifically for them.
Any other concepts or topics you'd like to discuss today that we didn't cover?
I have one more non-hormonal, non-prescription option that we didn't talk about, which is acupuncture. Again, really difficult to study, and it all depends on the provider and where the filaments or needles are being placed, plus the individual. But because it is really low risk, I do talk about it. There are some studies specifically in breast cancer survivors with hot flashes and acupuncture. So I always tell them, you know, it looks like it's weekly at first, and then they can push those sessions off. The biggest issue, I think, is just financially getting acupuncture covered can be really hard for our patients. But I do bring that up as an option for them.
Well, that's really wonderful to know. And for people who are needle phobic or for some reason can't do acupuncture or choose not to pursue it, could they try acupressure, cupping, or coining?
Yeah, I think the risk is going to be low, right? As long as you're going to a reputable place that you trust. We don't have probably high quality evidence that those would help, but just because we don't have the study doesn't mean it won't help any one individual.
Well, this has been tremendously informative and educational and also very fun. So thank you very much for joining me, Dr. Nordhus and Ms. Klingworth. My name is Dawn Davis, and you've been listening to Mayo Clinic Talks podcast, talking about menopause and topical and non-hormonal therapies. Thank you for your time. Thank you for what you do for patients. And thank you for listening.